The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Right on.
Everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us? Simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today.
Welcome to the Tony Tennis Show by Partisan Voices of the People. I'm Randall Jefferson.
I'm Pat Edward.
Our show looks at major issues affecting the nation and region from a bipartisan perspective. We want to hear from you. Our listeners, call, ask questions. Our calling number is 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306. Our phone lines are now open. You could also send us your comments via social media. Our Twitter handle is @ToneAndTenor. Our Instagram handle is @ToneAndTenorRadio. You can also like us on our Facebook page. Just type the words Tone and Tenor in the Facebook search engine to find us. Today is the final series of our three-part series, COVID-19, Justice Disparities, Upcoming Elections, and the Power of the Judge, Part 3.
Mm-hmm. You know how we know where there's elections, right? Street cleaning, random construction, you know, fixing roads.
But as we've been continuing this series, we are honored to have two more of our candidates for a Court of Common Pleas with
Absolutely.
Us today. You know, we're not going to talk about everyone should know what the Court of Common Pleas does by now. We've done it 3 weeks in a row, and you should know what their jobs are. So we're going to go straight to our candidates. And first, I'd like to introduce Ms. Carolyn Turner, Esquire. Turner was born in Germany to a military family. Her first career was as a registered nurse in England. While living in Spain in the 1990s, she moved by the Ratkat cities occurring in the Bosnia-Serbian War. And despite her broken Spanish, she was inspired to raise such funds for a refugee camp. She was invited by the Aragonese government to represent her city on a humanitarian convoy to Bosnia, where she saw firsthand unspeakable suffering. Now, you see that every day in Philadelphia. Mm. It was that experience that pushed her to earn further qualifications to fight injustice and transition to practicing law. Turner worked as a public defender in New Jersey, working first in South Jersey and then in Trenton. She has been with Swartz-Cullerton PC, concentrating her practice on nursing home negligence and medical malpractice. She is admitted to the practice and admitted to practice in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. She earned her master's degree in bioethics from the University of Pennsylvania and her Juris Doctorate from Temple University Beasley School of Law and an LLM in trial advocacy from Temple University Beasley School of Law. Also in the studio with us is Mr. Nicholas Nick Camus, Esquire. Camus began his legal career as an assistant public defender at the Defenders Association of Philadelphia. Nick is a partner at Legis Group, LLC, where he tirelessly advocates for his clients' economic interests. He has worked at the top personal injury defense firm, where he handled police brutality, wrongful termination, and catastrophic injury cases. His fight for righteousness and justice extended to national policy, where he served as a Democratic counsel for the Congressional Oversight and Government Reform Committee, representing former President Obama's administration in the defense of Obamacare, clean and renewable energy programs, and voting rights. Committed to improving minority and disadvantaged communities, he serves as a trustee and chair of the legal ministry at Mother Bethel AME Church, Winfield Residents Association Board of Directors, and previously sat on the board of directors of the Christian Street YMCA. Nick provides assistance to those in need by volunteering with the North Philadelphia Participatory Defense Hub and provides pro bono legal services to underprivileged Philadelphians. He is a member of the Barristers Association of Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Bar Association, where he previously served as the chair of the Board of Governors. Over the course of his career, he has been admitted to practice in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, California, Colorado, and the District of Columbia and the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. He earned his BA from the University of Maryland and his Juris Doctorate from Howard University School of Law. Later in the show, we will be joined by District Attorney candidate in the second half of the show, Mr. Carlos Vega. We will read his bio when he comes on. Nick, Carolyn, welcome to the Tony Tennis Show. Have fun. We don't debate. We have a conversation because we want people to know, one, we need to let them know there's an election on May 18th because it's quiet. And we need to know that two of you are vying for 8 spots for the Court of Common Pleas. There are 16 people actually running for that. So you have a 50-50 chance.
50-50 indeed. Well, thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here. I appreciate it live and in person. And I'm absolutely honored to speak with you and your guests.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm also really honored. Thank you so much. Thank you for that introduction. I'd just like to add that I'm also heavily involved in voluntary work in Philadelphia, too. I work with the food sharing program, Sharing Access, mm-hmm. and I'm a voluntary mediator for the Good Shepherd Mediation Program, doing the housing eviction mediation at the moment. I'd just like to say that, too. But it's lovely to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's always good to have folks. You know, I'm not even going to say we're at the end of what could be this pandemic, but it's good that we can have people in the studio face-to-face. And as we know, we're also live streaming on Tone and Tenor Facebook Live. So people get to see who you are, you know, and you have a chance to, instead of pounding the pavement, have a chance to sit and relax. You can loosen your tie if you want, you know, because we are totally, you know, this is a conversation, not a debate. You know, relax, have fun.
Well, I got to have my pictures from my Instagram feed, so I'm going to leave it buttoned up.
I got you.
Pat, you know, this is your final. You have the first voice in this with our final two candidates for Court of Common Pleas.
Yeah, no, I just, you know, I'm glad, you know, folks showed up. You know, Nick and I had a very candid conversation, you know, with some others. And, you know, it turned into this. So I'm glad they showed up. Carolyn sent me like a presentation via text, you know, which was extremely impressive to her platform and what she stands for, what she believes in. So I think it's always important to have, you know, different folks, because this is really what a representation of what the city looks like, right? Mm-hmm. It's not all black. It's not all white. It's not all, you know, whatever your background is.
And,
or religion.
And it's not about the endorsements. It's not about, you know, because as we were talking earlier, there's no such thing as an off election. But, you know, as we move into towards May 18th, there's crickets. I don't know what you guys is hearing, but there's crickets. You know, a lot of people don't even know there's an election coming. And when you say you're and the first question, when you approach a person, you're saying you're running for the Court of Common Pleas in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And you know, we always, when we have a lady, we go ladies first. So, Carolyn, what is the reaction people give you when you approach them and you say, I'm running for the bench, just be it fighting for a seat on the bench of Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia County?
Well, as you can see, I've got my name blazoned all over my T-shirt, and they look at me incredulously and say, oh, you mean you? You're running for judge at the Court of Common Pleas? And I say, yes. And they ask me, what's your platform? And I say, I'm running on a criminal justice reform platform. And then they, a lot of them ask me what my platform exactly is, and I give them my three main issues that I'm fighting for. Mm-hmm. And the reaction is generally very, very positive. I get a lot of great feedback and gratitude for the fact that I'm fighting for these things. And I mean, I have made this my city. I've adopted it as my city. I grew up all over the world. But here is where I've settled. I've been around here for the last 23 years, but obviously never lost my accent. And I love Philadelphians. I love the people I meet. And I'm actually having a lot of fun with this part of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Is this, and we'll get to you in 1 second, is this your first time running for any type of office?
Yes, it is. Gosh. Bit of a shock to the system.
Yes,
not quite what I expected.
Nick, I remember, you know, I was telling Pat, I said, you know, the first person I ran into in front of Produce Junction was this guy named Nick Kamau. That said, I gave him the car, said, can I come on your show? And I told Pat, I said, I haven't heard from this guy. You know, and you were the first person that actually approached us.
So you didn't, I called you, you didn't return my call.
That's what Pat said to us. y'all got together on that. But you're here. I mean, that's the point.
No, definitely.
You know,
Sharon was awesome. Yeah,
you know,
awesome
that you're here. So tell us what the reaction are. I know what the reaction was. I saw it firsthand when you were trying to get your petition signed. And I just happened to be going in. And this is, I wasn't working with him or to our listeners. I just happened to be pulled up to. And this young man was standing out there, will you sign my petition? I'm going to run for Court of Common Pleas. And I'm Nick.
Come out. Yeah. So, you know, basically my perception is very similar to your explanation for what's going on in the streets right now. It's crickets. Mm-hmm. When I approach people, you know, folks are saying, I didn't even know that there was an election coming up. I was like, well, you know that there's an election every 6 months. And they say, yeah, but, you know, we're just coming off of the general election and I didn't hear anything about it. And what are you running for? And I explained to them the Court of Common Pleas. Yeah. And they say to me, well, what's that? What does that do? You know, what do you do as a Court of Common Pleas judge? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it gives me an opportunity to explain to them really, you know, how important, you know, the Court of Common Pleas
is. If you were to win, you would be, both of you, either one of you, would be sitting on a bench for 10 years. You make a decision on somebody's life.
Not only someone's life, but when you think about the impact that Court of Common Pleas judges have, mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like to put it into perspective a little bit.
Sure.
Juxtaposing judges on the Court of Common Pleas with, we'll say, the President of the United States, mm-hmm. right? So the President of the United States, how many votes did he get in Philadelphia? 600,000 votes.
You're talking about the president.
Yeah,
he got less votes, even though they said he got less votes than the previous presidential election.
But so, I mean, we're talking about, you know, half a million people, right? More than half a million people. Mm-hmm. Well, the expected outcome in this election is somewhere between 140 and 160,000, mm-hmm. right? This is for judges who are in Philadelphia. Well, let me talk to you a little bit about the impact that judges have. Mm-hmm. A single judge in Philadelphia can hear about 10,000 cases a year. Mm-hmm. All right. Wow. So you have 10,000 defendants. We'll just say it's criminal court. You have 10,000 defendants and 10,000 victims, mm-hmm. and you have the families. And you have the community. So we're talking about, in the course of 10 years, upwards of 2 million people who are directly or one step removed indirectly affected by the decisions of a single judge. Single. And there are eight judges who are there's eight vacancies and 16 candidates. And so we're talking about, multiple millions of people mm-hmm. who are going to be directly impacted by this. Yet we only have about 150,000 people who are probably going to be voting. Whereas you think about the impact that these judges have, right? I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. about decisions that impact the very freedom mm-hmm. of individuals. We're talking about decisions that impact the ability for parents to maintain their parental rights.
Yep.
We're talking about decisions that impact an individual's ability to maintain a living wage and continue working, right? Huge, huge impacts. Whereas the president, very important, hugely important, absolutely. But what is the direct impact that, you know, the decisions a president is going to make on your daily life?
On your daily life.
Outside of an executive order, not much.
Right, right. So, you know, I explain that to them and they're like, wow, you know, I didn't really fully appreciate the impact and the need for me to vote. And then the next question is, why haven't I heard about this?
The bad part about that
you haven't heard about it because there's three people that get paid $160,000 a year, and probably not doing their job.
Right, and we actually, last week, we actually had one of the commissioners here, and we asked that same question.
Yep.
I don't pull any punches. We asked that question, but again, when you have... Yeah, and Carolyn, we can speak to this if you would like. When you have folks saying they are not backing anyone in an election, when you have a party saying we're not backing anyone, but yet and still the party boss sends you a memorandum, Carolyn, and asks you to step out of a race.
Let me just jump in there real quick before we get to that. I'm sorry mm-hmm. for interrupting, but there's this one last point that I wanted to make. Mm. In the presidential election, you have money coming from all over the country. You know, the Democratic National Committee is pumping tons of money in, doing a lot of voter outreach and a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And so in this local election, unfortunately, you know, Philadelphia just doesn't have that same kind of resource. Mm-hmm. And so not nearly. I mean, when you look at
what's their budget again?
Yeah, but we have the resources, but... You know, we're not going to defend Philadelphia and what the resources are, but you know, we're back to this, you know, and I have to say this. We're talking about voter suppression. You know, there are other ways to suppress a vote or suppress, and that doesn't mean going to the voter. That means going to the candidates and saying, okay, if you do X, I'll do Y, you know. If you do this, you were a victim. I'm saying this. Bob Brady, you should not have sent a memorandum. If you say you're staying out of a race, you stay out of a race. You know? So if you would like to speak on that, we can speak on that, but...
Well, I feel that becoming a judge was a calling for me because mm-hmm. I have had particularized professional experience as a public defender for many years in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about that in a minute because there's something very relevant about my experience in New Jersey. But I've also had private experience with the immigration system that has led to huge tragedies. So for me, running for judge has been like a calling. I've seen how many decisions, how many people's lives are ruined by the decisions that judges make.
Yeah.
And I have really clear ideas about how to make the justice system fairer and better, especially for black and brown communities, especially for people who have been the most ravaged by our present criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. So for me, this is a calling. And I was not expecting all the political stuff. I guess I was very naive when I came into this. And, first of all, my signatures were contested, and I was told by the party people that, you know, they were only doing that to vet me. They knew my signatures were fine. And then there was this, question about I was asked to get off the ballot and I would be appointed at a future date. And I said, no, thank you very much. And I was told that, the party would come at me because of that decision. But you know what? This is my calling. I'm doing it because I have to do it. I feel a personal calling to become a judge because I can make really big changes to people's lives, one case at a time, one courtroom at a time, one judge at a time.
Sure.
And, I really believe that even though the higher-ups have not all gotten together like they did in New Jersey and decided that the cash bail system needed changing. Mm. And in fact, our Supreme Court says that our bail system is absolutely satisfactory. Well, let me tell you this. At this moment in time, we have 4,818 people in our county jail.
Mm.
Only 155 of those people are serving county sentences. So over 4,600 people are either waiting for trial or on probation detainers. They're in the most horrendous conditions right now. Mm. Corrections officers are resigning. A lot of them aren't coming to work because it's such bad morale. They're watching inmates on video surveillance. Mm. People have been dying in the last few weeks in the jails because the conditions are so bad. And a lot of these cases are going to be either downgraded or eventually dismissed, and people are there because they simply cannot afford the bail money to get out, and we have to do something about this.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that. So you remember I used to be a monitor. I can't like say what program, but I worked for a small nonprofit, and I was a monitor where I would go in. It's almost like being a social worker. And there was a young man who was 21 years old, still on juvenile bail. Really?
It's my brain.
Just because he couldn't afford $2,000, which, to me is not a lot of money, right? But for some people, it really is. If you ain't got it, $2,000 is a lot of money, right? On average, what's like $1,500 to get out, or get out on your own recognizance? And again, in America, you get as much justice as you can afford. So,
exactly.
The point that Nick made, there are certain things, but there are some simpler ways where we can get the information out. Like where I live uptown. That don't happen. Us not knowing about voting, and it don't happen.
The Temple Ward happens in the different wards.
Yeah.
And, if in those wards that continue to vote, they're out. But there is no such thing. There should never be a such thing that there's an off election, off year, off whatever. But to both of you, when you're out there and you think you're out there, what significant changes, if you were to win a seat on this bench, and we know that you can't, some of your volunteer practices may have to stop, some of the things because now that you're a judge, you may come in contact. What significant changes, or how would you make, to continue to, because I guess first question is, do you agree that we have a broken justice system?
Yeah, so when you look at
I asked the direct question.
He took a deep breath. So.
Absolutely. I think justice needs to be analyzed and assessed based on its impact and its dissemination fairly, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you look at our system, you have approximately 47% of our population is African American in the city. Yet about 73.6% of everyone who is currently incarcerated is African American. Mm-hmm. Question is that just?
No.
I would posit no, it's not, right? So what's the cause of that? Well, we have a lot of different causes of that. Mm-hmm. One of which is over policing. One is access to attorneys. One is economic positioning within society. And, you know, when you look at the people who are currently incarcerated, the majority of people are incarcerated right now in Philadelphia for nonviolent offenses because they either have a probation detainer or they can't afford bail, right? Yep. And so to the extent that I can make any impact or any change, certainly it's not going to be to legislation, you know, eliminating cash bail, but as a judge who is responsible for making decisions regarding bail, you know, bail motions, you know, it's really important to look at whether the defendant is a danger to the community and is a flight risk. And if they're a danger to the community, then they don't need to, there's no bail. They shouldn't be out on bail.
Listen, you ain't getting argument. Listen, you ain't getting no argument. Listen, listen. Pookie,
Colin, put your perspective on this.
Pookie needs to stay in jail. If Pookie keeps getting, have repeat violent offenses where he's putting his hands on other people, I don't disagree. I don't see what the issue is.
Colin, your perspective.
Yeah, well, there's other factors that I would look at as well. One of them is likelihood of conviction, which is not something that a lot of judges look at. It's not statutorily one of the factors. But you know what? So many cases are brought, the cases are stacked. Like somebody might have had a drug in their pocket, but they're suddenly not just, you know, possession. It's possession with intent to distribute. It's school zone. It's public park. It's all those things. And all the way up so to make it felonies when actually the underlying charge was a misdemeanor. What judges can do is they can streamline it right down, right at the beginning, see what charges are going to stick, because that way you're demanding from the prosecutors the evidence to see what charges are going to stick. Because a lot of people, they end up dismissing all the stacked charges, and you end up with some minimum kind of misdemeanor, and they shouldn't have been in jail all that time anyway. So you can really streamline cases right at the beginning of the case. If a defense lawyer brings a motion to reconsider bail, I'll not only look at danger to society. Obviously, you weigh all the bail factors. You look at their ability to pay. Our Supreme Court makes you do that. We absolutely are supposed to see what people's ability to pay the cash bail is. And that gets forgotten very often. We look at their ties to the community, whether they've got a job, whether they've got family members and support, whether they can get the support they need to, you know, get things to keep from not appearing at court or committing potentially new crimes. We look at the whole thing. And what my idea is, I've been talking to many leaders in community, and we have so many resources in our communities that we're not using as a court system. We have drug and alcohol addiction treatment programs. We have psychiatric trauma healing, GED programs, job training, skills, you know, just training people for skills so that they can get employed. We have so many rich resources that we're not using. And why not refer people in the, I'm not talking about people who've murdered people. I'm talking about the vast majority of people, as Nick just said, are in for nonviolent offenses. Why not refer them to places where they're actually going to get some help and solve some of the problems that might have caused, you know, them being in the courtroom in the first place?
Or we can start with the fact that trauma, right, is a huge, is a huge thing that's not talked about. And again, you know, black and brown folks, our biggest issue is that we're the only faction of people, and I'm saying this again, who have not gotten a fair opportunity to recover from our Holocaust. Period. I mean, there's folks who haven't got, who literally America didn't even do nothing to them, and they still got paid.
Right.
I mean, again, anybody wants to, you can meet me anywhere. We have the information. But real quick, I guess Randy, you want to say something, then we'll cut to break.
You know, only break. One of the things, I mean, that we really, that both of you, and we've have found out throughout the folks that we have had in studio on air that's running for Court of Common Pleas, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of innovative ideas coming to come that each one wants to what do you think the success rate of trying to implement those, if and when, because see, I don't say I want, it's if and when, Carolyn, you win, if and when,
Nick
if and you win, you know, how successful? I know it's, you got 10 years. Are you going to try to stretch? Are you going to go in guns a-blazing, so to speak, or that's a poor term.
That's a poor term.
No.
Well, so I mean, there's some things that can be done immediately, and those small changes can make a dramatic impact. One of which is, to the extent that I'm in criminal court and I have people on my probation, mm-hmm. it's really important, I believe, for me, as it is for all of the judges, to monitor the people who are on their probation. Mm-hmm. What happens is, when folks are on your probation and they violate their probation, they may have a new charge or a new offense.
Yeah,
you have to pull it. You have to do the research and find out, you know, cross check your probationers with the dockets, mm-hmm. And make sure that there's not a detainer that's lodged unnecessarily.
Okay,
you know, folks could be sitting behind bars on a probation detainer that the judge doesn't even know about.
Wow.
For months and months and months before it gets to their desk, and so judges. You know, one of the things that I want to do is make sure that I'm monitoring my dockets regularly, you know, every day, to make sure that there are no outstanding detainers on folks that need to be released. Right.
Yeah.
The way it works is if someone's on probation and they violate their probation, they get a new arrest. Mm. That's a violation of their probation. Just the fact that they were arrested makes it a violation.
Okay.
And there is a detainer that's lodged. That detainer basically means that it doesn't matter what the offense was. It could be jaywalking, right? If they get arrested on jaywalking, mm-hmm. Then they're going to be in jail and there's going to be a detainer. Mm-hmm. There's no bail associated with jaywalking. They should be able to you know, go back to the community, but because there's that probation detainer, they're going to be behind bars. And unless that detainer is lifted, they're going to remain there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just an example, but it's really important that anyone who is on my probation, I'm going to make sure that those detainers are not going to be remaining unnecessarily, so they can defend those cases from the community, and you know, continue to work, continue to be productive members of their community and of society.
And that's absolutely right, because all our practices have to be evidence based. Mm. I'm actually going to keep a spreadsheet with all my decisions,
oh, wow.
so that I can be accountable to the people who've elected me, mm. and I can be transparent.
Yeah, y'all two trying to start a revolution in here.
Yeah, well, it doesn't take much to make a spreadsheet each day with all the decisions you've made.
Well, I mean, things get lost in this. I've done...
Well, no, I want to be transparent, and mm. I want to be accountable, and I want to keep people accountable in my courtroom.
Nice.
So if I'm going to keep people accountable, you know, whether it's police officers, prosecutors, defense attorneys, whoever it is, mm-hmm. then I have to keep myself accountable too.
Awesome.
And I want to be able to look at the end of the year and say, oh, these people I put in community supervision, and guess what? They're doing really well, because I know they will. And I tell you how I know they will,
mm-hmm.
is because I was in New Jersey as a public defender when they introduced bail reform beginning of 2017.
Mm.
It's been spectacularly successful. The jails are half empty. And recidivism rates and violent crime have not gone up. They're closing prisons in New Jersey right now.
Yeah, that ain't gonna happen
here.
So
we know that it works. We know that it works being supervised in community.
Hey, I don't disagree.
The recidivism rate model was actually done by Senator Portman out of Ohio and former Congressman J.C. Watts.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the stats on that, and, you know, having worked with both of those gentlemen, you know, the models are out there. Mm-hmm. We just have to stop always begging for money to throw good money after bad money and actually do the work, you know, and our judges have to be, you know, you brought up something, Caroline, a word, accountability. It seems like there's three new buzzwords out there for this year: democracy, transparency, and accountability. Those are buzzwords. We, myself as a voter, we have to hold all of you accountable. We have to make sure that you're transparent. And if we live in a democracy, everyone should be allowed, if they meet the qualifications, to run for an office and work towards, because if you're having an election and nobody's running and only an incumbent, we are not living in a democracy because people are not given a choice.
So, and this is to put some reverence behind what
Randall's saying. Basically, there's so in the last election, right, there was, what, 20? In our immediate area, we have 26 state reps, right? Only 19 of them. No, sorry. Only 19 of them ran unopposed.
Wow.
There's nobody doing that. And again, I know some of these people personally. Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, some drink with, smoke cigar. Listen, they're not all doing a good job. And some of them I've told them to their face, mm-hmm. right? Because I can like you, but not like your politics.
Exactly.
Right? A lot of us are really emotional about this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, you know, religion and politics. Like, mm-hmm. don't talk about these things. Like, nah, sometimes, you know, you need to be able to tell a friend or somebody you know. Or somebody you've done business with in the past, right? Particularly me, you know, as you guys know, I've written legislation, I've done legislative research. And again, I don't have a problem telling people, look, that policy was reactive, right? Or, you know, that, you know, piece of legislation you put in is trash. Mm-hmm. Why is it trash? I can always go to the numbers. Like, I'm always going to break it down for you. But, you know, again, we need to be able to have these healthy conversations. And I think it's, I definitely appreciate you guys having another approach instead of the whole, I guess, the party approach. That's what we call it. You know what I mean?
You know, that's, you know, I have a different word for it, but
we can't use it on air.
and you know, and it's not one party. You know, it's, and you know, we're bipartisan. It's both parties.
Yeah,
there's good and bad in both
parties. Absolutely.
You know, and we, again, I'm going to use the wrong word. We have to start policing ourselves as well.
Yeah.
Amen.
You know?
Absolutely.
And until we start doing that and folks start really understanding that, you know, we're in trying times. We're in trying times, and we need to, you know, make sure that we are electing people, putting folks in these positions that affect our everyday life. Because the old saying, and if you listen to the Senate, and will say, I've been there when you got there, and I'll be there when you're gone. Talking about the president. So you think about it. As judges, you will be there when a mayor, when everyone is 4 years a senator, unless they stay. I mean, the only way that you guys leave, you're voted out after 10 years, there's a disciplinary action, or, God forbid, you meet your untimely death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, a quick shout-out to Nakisha Biller, who's watching. Yeah, some pretty cool comments here.
But we're actually, you know, we appreciate you guys, and we want to give each one of you a minute to talk, say what's on your mind. Make sure you give us your ballot number and how folks can reach out and follow your site. And we will make sure and let you know that this show, you can use any part of it you may want.
We won't charge you.
You know, because we want to make sure people get to know who Colin Turner is and who Nicholas Kamau. What? Kamau? Kamau is what? Who do I know? I know somebody named Kamau.
You were sold on this Kamau thing, man.
Both of you are not your generations. You were born in Germany and traveled the world, Colin, and your background.
My father's from Kenya.
Father's from Kenya.
Yeah, so similar to President Obama, my father's from Kenya, and he is Kikuyu. Right. If you're familiar with the Mau Mau rebellion, so Kamau is a surname which means silent warrior.
Nice,
silent warrior.
That's appropriate.
That's appropriate. So we'll start with
yes. So as you're talking, I'm thinking about. You know, all of the rollbacks to voting rights. You see this going on through, in the Senate right now, and these, Georgia and in Texas, and they're moving towards, curtailing folks' right to vote. And it just makes me think about all the blood that was shed for our people to have the right to vote. Mm. It reminds me of John Lewis. It reminds me of, all of the pain that we went through as a people, we went through so much to have the right to vote, and it's being taken away. And the election is upon us.
Right.
You know, it's on Tuesday.
May 18th.
On May 18th. And I'm just so moved that there are so few people who are engaged. It just breaks my heart.
Yeah. Especially so how can people reach out to you and your voter number?
Yeah. So you can find me at kamaufordjudge.com. That's Kamaufordjudge.com. And I'm ballot number 14. So I'm on the first column at the very last name on the first column. There's three columns on the first column at the very bottom, number 14.
Awesome.
Oh, and Carolyn.
Real quick, Wilson just texted. Yes, Wilson Alexander is watching as well. We appreciate you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you, Wilson. This white woman with a British accent is determined. I'm fighting, as I said earlier,
I love you guys.
Not only because I have experienced as a public defender the injustice in this system, I've experienced it personally. This is a personal fight for me, a personal calling. I will make a difference. I will change things. Mm-hmm. One judge at a time, one courtroom at a time. My website is www.turner, like Tina Turner, without the moves or the voice. Think of it without anything much.
I'm glad you guys are relaxed, seriously.
www.turner4judge.com. I'm at Caroline Turner for Judge on Instagram. My ballot number is number 9, which comes at the top of the list of the Court of Common Pleas candidates. I am not endorsed by the Democratic Party establishment, as you pointed out, Brandon, at the beginning of the interview. I did not know about the politics of this whole situation, but I am fighting for justice for black and brown communities who've been the most, as I said earlier, ravaged by the system. And I'm so invested in it. I would love people to consider voting for me.
Awesome. Yeah.
Great. Thanks. Want to thank both Nick and Carolyn for joining us for the Court of Common Pleas. And we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to bring in the candidate for Philadelphia County District Attorney of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Mr. Carlos Vega Esquire. So on the other side of the break, Mr. Vega is here, so we're going to bring him in.
Awesome.
You know, you guys can, if you want to sit or you want to leave, you can.
All right, thank you so very much.
Nothing. Are back. You are listening to Tone and Tenor on WWDB 860 AM. Today's topic is justice disparities, upcoming elections, the power of the judge, part 3. That was unsolved mysteries, because we're still trying to figure out the mystery of why nobody knows that there's an election.
There's an election. But in the studio with us, Annie rushed to get here, and we. Mr. Carlos Vega Esquire, we appreciate your being here. And he is a candidate for the Philadelphia County District Attorney, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mr. Vega, welcome to Tone and Tenor Show. Everyone knows that, and we can say, you know, you're a transplant from South Bronx, New York City. You served 35 years as a prosecutor in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, and you became the first Latino prosecutor in the homicide unit in 1987. He also worked a second job at night for 15 years at UPS to support his family during that time.
Wow.
As the first, you know, and he's helping, he wants to help to Pennsylvania. Carlos Vegas has devoted his career to protecting Philadelphia. He's helping to overturn wrongful conviction and standing up for marginalized communities. He attended Fordham and earned his Juris Doctorate from Boston College Law School. Mr. Vega, it's an honor. Thank you for joining us today. I know you're on the last roads of, you know, folks, there's an election on May 18th. May 18th, he's running for district attorney. We have common pleas courts. We have several, but let's talk to Mr. Vega.
Yeah. So just, you know, so people know, a DA is a lawyer that is elected or chosen by government officials, or they're voted to represent on the state government in criminal cases brought in a designated county or judicial district. A DA's duties typically include reviewing police arrest records, deciding whether to bring criminal charges against or arrest people, and prosecuting criminal cases. The DA may also supervise other attorneys known as assistant district attorneys or ADAs. In some states, district attorneys may be called a prosecuting attorney, county attorney, state's attorney, all that cool stuff. So just in case you didn't know, if you don't know, now you know.
Yep.
So,
Mr. Vega,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
I appreciate you giving me a voice right now.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we're laid back. I'm gonna let you tell the constituents that when you want to vote for, who you are and why you want their vote.
Mm. Well, who I am is this: I was born and raised in New York, and my family came from Puerto Rico.
Okay.
The person I am is because of my mother. She was a strong influence in my life. Mm. She came as a young lady, 16 years old, to America.
Okay.
And worked in a factory and saved enough money to bring my grandmother and my aunt to New York. She opened a grocery store, a bodega, in New York during the late 60s and 70s. And that was the height of the heroin epidemic back then in the States.
Mm.
So at that time, the store was pre-plexiglass, where you had no barriers. If you were going to get robbed, you were going to get robbed.
Yeah.
So we were robbed several times. My mother was robbed at gunpoint. My big sister and my grandmother were robbed at knife point. So I was always worried about their safety. Mm-hmm. And in running a grocery store, it's all hands on deck. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the one who stocked the shelves and everything. But also growing up, the guys I grew up with, the older guys my age, a lot of them got swallowed up by the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they got addicted to drugs. A lot of them died of overdoses. Others went to Vietnam and didn't come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then others started committing crime to feed that habit, or others start selling drugs to feed that habit.
Mm-hmm.
So I always want to be a prosecutor for two reasons. Number one, I always want to be that voice for my mother who, you know, when you think of victims of crime, they don't have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
You're robbed, you call the police, and is that it?
I hope they show up, especially in the 70s and 80s. I spent the first half of my childhood in Brooklyn, so I know what you mean.
So I want to be that voice, you know, because I'm bilingual.
Mm.
I speak Spanish. And, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, there are a lot of families that the child is the interpreter when you're going to mm-hmm. a doctor's office or whatever. So I want to be that guy that I look like them. I know where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was poor. I know what it is to be hungry and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But also I wanted to give a chance to those people that didn't have the chances I had. I think I'm lucky because, number one, my mother didn't play. You know, I was afraid of her more than any policeman or whatever. But also she worked hard to put me and my sisters and my brother through Catholic school. And it was two reasons. One, she was a strong believer in religious instruction.
Sure.
But also, the Catholic schools at that time were safe.
Mm.
And my friends went to public school. It was a war zone. Like one of my good friends, in sixth grade, he was stabbed in the chest. And you think of a parent sending their kids to school and you get a call saying your kid's in the hospital. He got stabbed.
Wow.
So, you know, I always wanted to be that guy that in the court system, I thought it was important to be part of the system so you can try and bring some change or some fairness. And although I've tried 30 years in homicide, you know, that's the worst of the worst in mm-hmm. terms of the crime. You know, what mm-hmm. you do, you can't take back. It's not like stealing something. You took a life.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been able to give, like, non-trial dispositions of not throwing away the key, you know, because not every case is a life imprisonment.
Sure.
So there are people I've given a chance to. I'll use an example of recently in running for office. This developer told me his contractor is a guy I sent away to prison for killing someone. And I remember the case. And although it was an execution, he took someone, he was a drug dealer, mm-hmm. and someone was stealing from his workers, so he killed them. I gave him a deal of 20 to 40 years. He did his 20. He has a family now. He has a business. And he says, hey, I did it, but Carlos gave me a chance as opposed to throwing away the key. Mm-hmm. And then on several cases that have been death penalty cases, I've advocated for my office not to seek it, you know, because I believe if you're going to seek that, it should be in the most extreme form, like a serial killer or killing a witness. So I think we have to really look at that very lightly. I think times have changed that we got to deal with the legislature, because I'm the executive branch. But people, right. if they don't believe in the death penalty, I think they got to vote and say, hey, let's change the rules. That way that's not an option. But as a DA, I had to really consider all aspects, although I would change it in terms of I wouldn't make that decision. I would have a committee deciding whether to seek that. Seek it only the most extreme forms, but mm-hmm. also invite the defense attorney to argue mitigation pre-trial to not seek the death penalty. Mm-hmm. But I've done that on my own many times, not to seek it.
Okay. What are your, because we know that, again, there's this thing where people think that, you know, judges and DAs have these magic wands. What do you think about, I guess, wrongful convictions? I know that was something that has been brought up a couple of times. So what if somebody's exonerated, do you believe in making them whole? Does that make sense to you?
I believe in making them whole, but really, how do you make someone whole when they've lost 10, 20 years?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like me in a murder case when a mother's child is killed and there's a guilty verdict. I can't make you whole. What you want is your child back.
Sure.
So making them whole, I think that's a hollow answer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm glad they're out. Mm-hmm. They still have mm-hmm. life ahead of them, but you can never make someone whole who's been unjustly convicted. How do you get that time back?
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe in the conviction integrity unit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a unit that was well overdue because in my years there, they didn't have a unit per se. They had one or two people reviewing cases
mm-hmm.
when there are literally maybe hundreds of cases saying, review mm-hmm. this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they have a unit. And I said, day one, I would expand that unit because the example is I was a line DA. You know, I wasn't reviewing cases. Right. I was prosecuting cases. But I remember a case, and his name is George Cortez. He was serving life, and he got a new trial. And the defense attorney who knew me says, can you take a look at this? I don't think my guy did it. Mm. And I looked at it, you know, reviewed it, and he didn't do it. So I was able to exonerate him. But being a seasoned prosecutor with investigators, I found out who the true killer was. We arrested him, and he pled guilty to murder.
Mm.
So I think when I'm DA, I would expand that unit.
Mm.
But I need seasoned prosecutors because I was able to do that in 5 months because I know what I'm doing with my experience.
Mm-hmm.
What the office has now, with the exception of two people who have done some cases, they're people straight out of law school.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated from law school, technically I'm a lawyer. I didn't know anything. You have to have right. that repetition and train.
Mm.
So I would want to put in seasoned prosecutors with minimum 5 years experience. Hopefully some that have done defense work also,
mm-hmm.
seasoned prosecutors to review these cases. Because I've seen in reviewing it, unless you have the Innocence Project or you have money for a private lawyer, those cases are being reviewed first. And guys who are indigent, you know, been locked up right, 20 right. years, mm-hmm. they don't have the money. And they're at the back of the line, and that's unfair. Mm-hmm. So with a larger unit, I can address those cases of indigent people. And second, if you have seasoned prosecutors, and I've seen with the office now, they take 3 years mm-hmm. to review a case. It doesn't take 3 years to find out whether a guy didn't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it should take 5 months, mm-hmm. 6 months, no more than a year if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I really think it's important that we give those people in the back of the line a chance that is reviewed. So it must be a larger, more robust unit.
Awesome. Awesome. Unfortunately, we're running against the clock, but... how do people, your final thoughts, and how do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, not just that, you know, the final thoughts, are, you know, because these probably won't, they may or may not be your final thoughts, because regardless of who wins or wins, we, you know, hopefully we'll bring back the winner and really have an in-depth conversation, because we'll be going into the general election.
Mm. Well, what I like to say is, well, first of all, my website is vegafordA.com. That's V-E-G-A. FORDA.com. Mm-hmm. But the reason I'm running is this. I'm a single dad. I raised two children. Mm-hmm. I have three children. One is in Ireland, but the two I raised, my daughter and son, I raise them on my own. Mm-hmm. So with a lot of our victims, it resonates with me that I am a single dad. I had to work two jobs because as a city worker, you don't have a lot of money. But I couldn't turn my back on what I call my mothers who's lost their children, that I decided to work a second job so I could remain a DA to be that voice for victims. And the reason I'm running is because you've seen the murder rate, 499 murders last year. Mm-hmm. We may have 600 murders this year. And this past Mother's Day, we had 25 shootings. Seven young men were killed on Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. Three wounded are females. And my daughter's 24. My youngest is 17, a boy. Mm-hmm. And he wears the sweats and has the crazy hair. And, you know, I'm worried about he's the age and the ethnic group of your next victim. But also he's the age and ethnic group of potentially police misconduct. So he's walking a fine line of, is it trouble with violence? Is it trouble with people not being held accountable? Mm-hmm. I have prosecuted police officers in my career as opposed to the incumbent who has never prosecuted police officer, and during his administration, not a single police officer has gone to prison.
Wow.
So, but I've done it. One for a double murder, one for hiding evidence in the murder when his girlfriend killed somebody. I convicted her, and I convicted him for hiding that. So the reason I'm running is this. I'm a public servant. I see the cities in crisis. I think we need reform with addressing drug issues, mental health issues. But also, I need to make you safe. We cannot have people dying. It's unacceptable. And when we think of people of color, let's talk the reality. 87% of all murder victims are black. Mm. And then, you know, my people, when you talk about brown people, we're a lesser number, but we're still 12%.
Gotcha.
Add those numbers.
Signal from our
the flare is going up over there.
Over there, because we have another show coming in. But we want to thank you for, you know, coming. We know you rushed.
And thank you for sharing the information, too.
Sharing the information, because it's information that, you know, that people need to get. And we want to thank Mr. Carlos Vega for coming in. He is the candidate for Philadelphia County District Attorney. Mm-hmm. We want to thank our candidates for all of our candidates for district common pleas.
Commonwealth Court of Pleas.
And, you know, well, listen to us next week. I'm Randall Jefferson.
I'm Pat Edward.
And remember, there is an election May 18th.
Yeah.
Get out and vote.